Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
We'll take it right through council and all the way to the build. We'll take it to builders. We'll get the tenders from the builders on behalf of our clients, and then we will get the process built and get the house finished and then give to our clients after that.
This is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tyrone Shum, and in this episode, we're talking to CEO of MPI Group, Paul Mascant, whose history as a builder and property developer gives him the experience needed when it comes to subdividing and selling developments. His accomplishments have allowed him to build his own portfolio up to $10 million in just 5 years. In the 5 years when he started building his portfolio, Mascant also started National Property Investment Group, better known as MPI Group, which is a buyer's agent known for overseeing the entire development process. He shares what his typical day looks like.
So any sort of day, I'll arrive at the office around about 8 o'clock, check emails and inquiries for the night before is normally my first couple of hours. Then I will look at council applications, see where they're sitting at for our clients that already have applications in council. And then the last sort of part of my day, I would head out to site to give updates on the process or the progress of our builds that are happening at the time, and then report back them to the clients as well. And then whilst I'm out on site or driving the car, I'm generally on the phone all the time to agents trying to get new deals across the line. So we take it right from the buyers from buying the property for the client all the way through to the turnkey development process. So we'll take it right through council and all the way to the build. We'll take it to builders. We'll get the tenders from the builders on behalf of our clients, and then we will get the process built and get the house finished and then give to our clients after that. It's all the way through. We don't just buy the property and then just hand it to the client and say, "Well, there you go, you sort it out now." We take it right through to the end. And then the client can do whatever they want to do with it after that. If they want to, if they would like to sell, they sell. If they want to rent them out and keep building, recycling the equity, et cetera, then they can do that as well. So we have some clients that like selling and going again. We have some clients that like recycling the equity and going again. So yeah, it's just a bit of what your risk profile is like and what you're up for.
Mascant grew up in Melbourne as the youngest of four boys, leading a very active childhood.
Eastern suburbs of Melbourne, in a little suburb called Bayswater, which is not fancy, it's probably 45 minutes from Melbourne, I suppose. So I grew up there, got three older brothers, and yeah, that's about, I'm the youngest, so I used to get beaten up a lot as a kid. So I was the little punching bag for a while there. But that was okay. I grew up there. So I started my, I'm a builder. I'm actually a builder by trade. So I started my apprenticeship when I was 19, and finished that when I was kind of 23, went overseas for a bit and came home and started doing, sort of my own property developments, and then sort of grown into doing it for other people, basically. I thought this is kind of too good not to try and emulate again and again and again. So here we are. He's very sporty. Very sporty as a kid. Footy in the summer, cricket. Sorry, footy in the winter, cricket in the summer. Like a lot of Australian children. Oh, like I said, three big brothers, so we're always playing footy out the front or cricket out the front and whatnot. And the same thing, I was always bowling, and then when I finally got them out, they'd go inside and wouldn't bowl to me. So, so that was just, So that was pretty standard, but that's okay. Just the standard sort of childhood with other kids in the street. We'd all play, you know, sports and ride bikes and water fights and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, just a standard kind of childhood.
After leading such an active lifestyle in his youth, Maskant hopes to emulate this kind of upbringing with his children, but concedes some of the difficulties with the kind of upbringing today.
I kind of hope that it's not lost on my kids when they get a bit older, being able to go out and just do that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's definitely not something you see a lot of. And I'm trying to, I think it sort of starts young. When the kids are young, you try and make sure that they, they're outside a lot and playing in the garden, you know, digging for stuff and whatever. So yeah, I try and push them outside as much as possible, even in the wintry Melbourne months, which we're smack bang in the middle right now. So, but that's okay. We try and get them out there. And I always think about, well, what are the kids in Canada doing? It's negative 30 in there, and they're still, I'm sure they're still doing stuff outside. So yeah, we just got to deal with it. So it wouldn't be fun. We've got some family in Canada. We're over there, and they were explaining how, like, when they just get a big dump, they've just got to get everyone's just out there with shovels and trying to get their cars out of the driveways and stuff. It'd be pretty full on. But just is what they do. That's what they do. They're just used to it.
So after school, I guess primary school, you went to high school, right? And as you said, afterwards you went to get your apprenticeship. How did you fall into that? Because there's so many ways to actually go into either, you know, that industry. But how did you know that you want to go there? Did you have some kind of experience from family, or was it something that went, oh, cool, you know, I like to just do it because it looks interesting?
It was a bit of column A, a bit of column B, I suppose. I think I liked the idea of building my own house. I don't know why. I just liked the idea of being able to know how to do that. So that's probably the main reason why I got into it. I liked the idea of being able to do that. If one day I needed to build my own house because I needed shelter for whatever reason, I could do it. And that was probably the main thing. I knew that I wouldn't have to. I knew I wouldn't be in a situation where I'd have to, but I thought that was probably the main thing. I just like to know how to do this. And so that's what I did. That's what I did for a long time.
After losing interest in studying physical education at university, Maskant went down the path of becoming a builder's apprentice, where he learned all the tricks of the trade.
As an apprentice, everything. We did mainly extensions and renovations of houses. So that was we never got a new home. We never did new homes or anything like that. It was just extensions and renovations. So it was a lot of which is probably harder because you're dealing with old houses, which a lot of the old houses have kind of become, you know, they're not level anymore. They're not straight. So things you got to change, and you've got to kind of try your best to make things work, look right and be right and all that sort of stuff. With a new home, you rock up and it's kind of just there, and you can just get it all done properly. So that was good. So we just did a lot of renovations, a lot of weatherboard renovations. People that had a 3-bedroom home would want a 4-bedroom home and 2 bathrooms. And so you're putting on en suites and all that kind of stuff, new kitchens, bathrooms, decks, pergolas. You kind of name it, we did it. Yeah, we did everything. As an apprentice, you don't really learn until you're kind of qualified. You're out there on your own and you're doing things yourself, and that's when you start to learn a lot. As an apprentice, you learn, but you can always ask your boss. You can always say, hey, mate, what do I do here? What do I do there? And they just give you the answer. But when you're out on your own, it's all a bit different. And you can still call them if you want to and whatever, but you're on your own. So that's when you're, and when it's your money on the line as well, you make sure you want to try and get it done as efficiently and quickly as possible.
Maskant continued down this path and after 4 years became a fully qualified carpenter.
So I was a carpenter for a while, for a long time. And then I got my builder's license. And then once I got my builder's license, I started doing developments, just buying old houses, which looking back is probably not the best way to do it, but as I'm sure you're aware, property is quite forgiving with time. So if you hold on to it long enough, it doesn't matter too much. You can kind of make a few mistakes and then come out the other end and it's all okay.
Through his experiences, Mascan learned from the complications that can arise when renovating an old house.
I think the adding the value at the start of the renovation can be a bit time consuming, a bit costly. And then you've got to sit on that until you develop the back house, the subdivided property. So you're sitting on that property at the front for a while. So it's pretty capital intensive by doing that. If you can buy a better house at the front and then put a new house on the back, I think it's much more valuable. Even if you're paying a little bit more to get in to that property, a few less headaches as well. You can rent them out easier. Initially, especially when you're doing a development at the back, you know, you want the front house rented as well. So you have to take a bit of a hit there as well, because people don't necessarily want a development happening whilst they're living in a house. I think over time, kind of worked out that maybe it's not the best thing to sort of buy an old place and put $50,000 or $60,000 into that, and then do a development at the back for $400,000 or $500,000 as well. It just becomes very capital intensive, and your money's sitting there for a long time idle. But that's what you learn when you do it, and that's what you get better at things as you do them. There's definitely exceptions to each rule. You know what I mean? Like some places are just worth it. You know, if you can get in there and you can get it for $100,000 less because it's got this and that wrong with it, then it is worth it. But you know what they call in the industry, sweat equity. You know, you're doing it yourself and getting in there and getting it done. It can be worth it. But yeah, from what I've sort of found, it's probably not always the best way.
Mascan's family were not major investors growing up, so the interest in property came from observing the houses he delivered to on his paper route as a child.
I can't remember much about property being mentioned at home or anything like that. No, not really. No, it was more about, I don't know. I remember as a kid, I used to look through the local paper and see the which houses sold for what and this and that. And you kind of look at, you know, I used to do a paper round when I was a kid as well, when I was probably 10 years old. And I remember liking seeing the houses I delivered the paper to in the paper as well. For some reason, I don't know why. It was just something that I looked at and did. And yeah, so maybe that's got something to do with it. Maybe not. I'm not sure. I don't, not really sure. But no, not really. It was more about just me sort of seeing an opportunity to be able to get ahead, I suppose.
Observing the developments happening around him, Mascan formulated his investment strategy of purchasing, developing, and subdividing.
You drive around any sort of street and you see developments happening, you know, you see a house get knocked down, put two houses there, three houses, four houses, or you see a house getting built behind someone else's house, or, you know, all these kind of little things. And it's like, oh, maybe if people are doing it, there's got to be some money in it. And then you have a go at it yourself, and potentially you don't do so well in the first one or the second one, but you learn things as you go and you get better at it over time. And that's when you start to really reap the rewards later on. So first property I purchased was actually my principal place of residency. So it was a little two bedroom weatherboard, and I turned that into a four bed, two bath, two living area sort of place. And this was well before I thought anything about property. It was more about just getting in there, renovating it, selling it, just get it done and get it sold. So that's what I did. I sold that one, made some pretty good money on that one. So
when renovating your own place and doing all the work yourself, it takes a lot of time, commitment and dedication, as Mascan learned with his first property.
It took 18 months to sort of from start to finish. You know, by the time I bought the place and I got the plans drawn and whatnot. But that was me being a bit lazy as well. And kind of back then I was a bit more like, I'll do everything. You know, I'm building, I'm painting, I'm plastering, I'm, you know, I'm doing tiling, I'm doing everything. But now everything's outsourced because I've learned that I'm wasting my time doing that when there's other opportunities I could be getting out there. So, but you only learn that by doing it. That's the thing. I remember I was hanging plaster sheets by myself, just painting wall. And it just was silly. Every weekend, just working all week and then working all weekend at the house. But it probably stood me in good stead, really, because I realized that that's not how you do things, but you don't work that out until you do it. And then I bought my principal place of residency again, and then I bought another investment property at the same time, and I subdivided the investment property. And that was, again, an older style place, so had to get in there and do bathrooms and kitchens and floorboards and move some walls and stuff like that.
Whether developing or simply buying and holding, Mascan assures that you'll see growth on your investment as long as you exercise patience and prudence.
Like I said to you before, property is pretty forgiving, you know. Like if you hold it long enough, it can turn out fine. I sold a couple of places pre-COVID, and we know now 2 years coming out of COVID, the market has been going gangbusters pretty much anywhere in Australia. And it has been going pretty good in the areas where I sold. So it's probably one of my worst mistake. You call it mistake? I'm not sure. I deployed the cash somewhere else though, so I took the cash from that and built another house. So that kind of helped that situation out, I suppose you could call it. In terms of purchasing, probably buying on a main road, which I've done. Which is sort of one of those things. Well, when I was doing this first, I didn't really understand any of that stuff. I didn't even think about it. I just thought, oh yeah, property, that's great. It's a house. Let's do it. It's got a big enough block of land. Let's get into it. But probably buying on a main road has probably been the biggest mistake I've made. Well, when I think is when you're selling a property, you're selling something that people want to love. I think, and you don't want them to walk in and pick anything out. You don't want to walk in and go, oh, the windows are no good, or the bathroom's a bit small, or the kitchen's a bit not quite what I wanted, or, you know, X or this or that, or there's no robes in the bedrooms, or there's no this, you know what I mean? And same thing, oh, it's on a main road. And I feel like when someone wants to buy a property, they want to be able to go, this is the best thing, I'm about to purchase this, I love it and I want it. And you also, if you've got two people loving or three people loving it, that's when the price goes up and up and up as well. But if you've got those knocks on your property, like I just mentioned, it makes it harder to sell, I think. And you're selling for a little bit. You're selling at a bit of a not a loss, but you're selling a bit less than what you could potentially get in a better street, for instance, or making sure that you've got all the mod cons and whatnot. So,
you know, you've had shared with us a moment where it's a learning lesson. What do you think has been one of your biggest aha moments along your property journey or property development so far?
The biggest aha moment, I think for me, would be when I decided to rent the houses out rather than sell them off. When I originally bought these houses, I was always about selling them, get in, do a development and sell it off. And then as I was kind of moving through and just kind of, they were going all right, the developments, and I kind of sort of looking at the rental market in the area, et cetera, and vacancy rates and whatnot, I thought maybe it's better to hold these for a while. And then started to get into a bit more learning about actual property investing rather than just, you know, property speculating, which was what I was doing, you know, by sort of buying, developing and selling. I was kind of, yes, making money, but keeping the money in the market is probably better than selling. And I understand sometimes you have to sell. I get that because, you know, banks won't let you borrow for whatever reason or a myriad number of reasons of why you have to sell. You know, family issues or whatever. You need the cash, and that's fine. You have to get out. But there's no point having money in the bank, sitting there doing nothing. You might as well have it in the market, giving you some rent on your money, and then the market growing over time as well. Being able to recycle the equity was stuff I didn't know about. I didn't know anything about that when I bought my first property. I didn't know you could go and borrow up to 80% on your property again and then keep moving. So all these things I learned as I was sort of going through, and I thought, oh, hang on a second, maybe it's better to hold these for a while until I really need to sell, or something comes up, or I want to buy my dream home, or I want to do this and I want to do that, then sell. But there's no point selling just to have a nice shiny figure in your bank account. It doesn't mean anything. Do you know what I mean? It's a number on a page. So that was probably my biggest aha moment. And then when I did a 3-unit development and the brand new houses all got rented out in the first afternoon, so we finished them all basically on the Tuesday or whatever, they all got done. All the occupancy certificates were all sorted. And Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock, all signed, done for the next 12 months. And then on Monday, there was, X amount of money put in my bank account. And I was like, oh, this is pretty good. That's the cash flow. Yeah. And then recycling the equity again, I was already at the bank. I was already at my broker on the Tuesday saying, well, this is what I've got now. These are done. This is the value. This is my cash flow from it. Where can we deploy this, this equity again? I think starting to rent them out was my biggest aha moment for sure.
Throughout his career as a builder, Mascan got more and more into property development, leading him to where he is today with NPI Group. He explains the significance of motive when selling property.
But then sometimes you have to sell. Sometimes you have to. Yeah. And if you're selling to deploy your cash somewhere else, if you're selling to have the money in a bank account and it's a shiny number on a page, then it's not the right thing to do. But if you're selling to maybe do another development or do a bigger development, or maybe buy a buy and hold strategy property or a commercial property or whatever, you know what I mean? It's all, as long as you're deploying it, even if you want to buy shares or something like that, like deploy it somewhere, to be able to keep working for you. But if it's sitting in the bank, it's just not worth it. Now for clients, we do exactly what I've done over the last 6 years. We buy development sites and then, like I said, get them through council and then get them through to the builders and get them built and then hand it back to the clients turnkey, and they can do what they want after. I'll give them a recommendation, but then don't have to take it. They can, if they want to sell, they sell. They might, like I said, they might deploy it somewhere else. They might want to go on a holiday, and that might be they might just want to do one development and go on a really nice, take their family on a really nice trip to Europe or America or something like that, and that's what they want to do, then great. And then they might come back and go again the next couple of years. But I kind of get a lot of repeat clients because they see what's happened and they have liked the process of doing it. Because it's been quite seamless, because we take care of everything. They kind of reinvest again. They go back to the bank and see what they can get, and they go again generally. It depends what stage people are at, basically. It depends what stage of their life they're at.
Mascan describes to us how he finds development opportunities and what his favorite type of investments are in his line of work.
It's just relationships with agents a lot of the time, which it's probably been harder in the last couple of years because the market's been so hot. Which is sort of coming back a little bit. I'm noticing agents are kind of calling me a little bit more now. It's just relationships with them. Being able to be ready to go is important as well. So have your pre-approvals in place and just be ready to go. When we find a site, we can do a quick due diligence on it. By speaking to surveyors, councils, all that kind of stuff that we need to speak to, make sure we're in the right zoning for developments. I think the main point is to be ready to go when the agent rings. We've got buyers there, and the thing about that is agents are happy to get a clean deal as well done, and they know when they ring us that if the price is right, we're not paying overs. We're paying market value. And we'll get the job done for them. By that afternoon, the property sold and we can move on. I really like the retain and builds, just the small ones. So you're not, it's not too capital in, like, it's not, you're not putting, millions of dollars into it. But I really like the retain and builds where you're building the house behind the front house, keeping the front house. I don't think bigger is always better. And as you get bigger, you get a lot more council issues. You got to deal with this and you got to deal with that. You get council taxes, car parks, open space living, all this kind of stuff that needs to come into it. So I think I really like the retain and build. So when they come up, I try and get them as much as possible. I think people like think, doing a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 unit subdivision is where it's at. But sometimes it's just not, because the headaches there are a lot more, they're a lot more prevalent than doing a simple subdivision. You can go through council just that little bit quicker. And I think you can get your money back a bit easier. So potentially if someone comes to me and they've got X amount of money, like, and they've got a lot of money, I might put them in three of those. Instead of doing a 6-unit site, I would say let's do 3 retain and builds, because I think you can go through it quicker, get it done all at the same time, and you'll make the same return.
So what goes into development once you're in there?
So we'd sort of we'll tender it out to three different builders. We've obviously done a lot, so we've got some good relationships with builders. They're willing to work with us, extras. So I generally send it to one volume builder and just a sort of everyday builder as well. I'll send it to them. That's two, and then generally the client has someone in mind as well. Very rarely they don't. They kind of have a friend of a friend or they know someone or whatever. So they'll send it. We'll send it to them as well if they'd like to do that process. And then we sort of work out who the best. Sometimes the cheapest isn't the best either. And we work out and we'll go through the contract for the client, looking at inclusions, exclusions, all that kind of stuff, and making sure they're getting exactly what they pay for. Because I think that can be a bit of a problem as well in the building industry. People sort of try and pull the wool over other people's eyes, and at least we've got a set of eyes from a trade background that can look at that and make sure that the client is getting exactly what they pay for. A lot of people don't understand that, and that's fair enough, because not everyone's in the building industry, and sometimes not even builders know what they're quoting. You know what I mean? So it's better for us to have an eye that we can look over it and say, yeah, this is exactly what you're getting. Some people will leave out the driveway, for instance, and not even know about it. Leave out the driveway, and then they go, well, the job's finished. Where's the driveway? And they're like, we never quoted that. Look at page 32 of the contract, and it'll say exclusion driveway. And the people are like, what do you mean? So make sure that kind of stuff doesn't happen. Because some builders will do that. We'll leave out driveways and stuff like that just because it's like, well, it's too hard basket and we'll leave it till the end and whatnot. So, yeah, so we make sure that all is in place. We look over it, look over the 3 quotes, and we sort of pick the best builder /price/ product. With our client, we don't sit there and go, we'll give them our recommendation, but they might for one reason or another want to go with another builder, and that's fine. It's their job, really. They're paying the money for it, so it's their job. So they can choose whatever they want to do.
In the property industry, your return of investment is always a key interest when investing successfully.
I like to work in 15 to 20% margins, generally. That's kind of where we're looking. With the buyer's agency part of it, I like to make sure that I'm buying in areas that are going to have capital growth as well over that couple of years when the development's being done. I think that's important as well, to get some uplift as well by holding the property. It's not just the development that's going to give you that cash or cash flow. It's going to be the market as well. So that's what we do. So market research is important from our end at the start. So I like to look 15 to 20%. Sometimes you can get more, and sometimes you fall a bit short, because development can be tricky and it can be expensive at times. And there's also little things that can happen. I've had a job before where we had to go to VCAT for a tree, for instance. The tree was on the boundary. Very frustrating. Tree on the boundary. Council knocked back the application. So we said, why? And they said, oh, the tree. And we said, okay, we'll take you to VCAT. We ended up winning, but it cost an extra $5,000. And these things happen, and there's not really a way that you can say that's not going to happen or that is going to happen, or, you know, it's sort of like, well, you've just got to sometimes have a go and find out along the way.
As we've mentioned for many episodes now, COVID had a profound impact on the property market. For Maskin, it was a struggle.
Challenging to say the least. Yeah, it is. It is. What do you do? It's been hard, but the best thing is that clients understand. It's not like they know that I'm saying to them, hey, look, we can't get material, but everyone else has got material. Like, it's, you know, you turn on the news or open in one paper and you can see that what's going on. So people understand. It is frustrating, and that's part of the unknown. Like we said earlier, part of the unknown. So we have some places that are going through getting developed now, which were bought pre-COVID. So how do you know that COVID's coming? You never know that. You never know when a once in 100 year thing's going to come up and bite you on the bum. So we just kind of. It's part of the unknown, and we just got to deal with it. And we try our best to try and get the builders to get there and get the job done. And we have some fixed price contracts. Some other contracts are on hold at the moment, waiting to see what's going to happen. It's just a bit of a wait and see. It definitely has been challenging, because this is a question I get all the time. Five times a day, that question comes to me. What's the go with materials and stuff? And I said, well, I don't know. But what I will say is that if you're buying a property now, you're not developing for a year and a half anyway. So hopefully by then the supply chains have opened up and things start to get back to a bit more normal, and we can move on from this. But it's a question I get asked a lot, and to be honest, I haven't really got an answer. It's just kind of one of those things we've got to just deal with as best as we can.
Maskin explains the process of his career path, explaining why he went into the business of buyer's agency and development.
Look, I love property. I really do. And I always I feel like I've almost done two apprenticeships, if that makes sense. I feel like I've done an apprenticeship as a carpenter builder, and I've done an apprenticeship in property. Self-taught, obviously, but sometimes I think that's the best way. And jumping in from doing developments to helping other people do developments, it was just a bit of a morphing, I suppose. Like, I'd get friends ask me, oh, what do you think of this, or what do you do here, and what would you develop this? And I'd say, yeah, that's a good one, or nah, that's no good because of this, and more and more people would ask, and then I'd be getting random phone calls saying, hey mate, I'm a friend of your mate, I'm looking to buy some property, what do you think? Just kind of like that, and just kind of a bit of a snowballing effect, I suppose. It just kept going and going, and and then I thought, maybe there's a business here. If people want to do this kind of stuff, where can we go with it? And yeah, so I started it, and here we are, basically. Yeah, you get repeat clients as well, and then you get people that are kind of older clients who their children have sort of spoken to me about things, and they're like, oh, I wouldn't mind. I need to do something for my retirement. I wouldn't mind getting on, doing something with this, and I need to make some extra money. And so they're kind of more you buy, develop, and sell. They want to keep the cash a bit more. That younger people potentially can rent them out, just kind of morphed from helping friends to helping a few family members, cousins, and stuff like that, and then moving on to friends of friends, and then just random people.
Success in any endeavor, whether it be property, sporting, or anything else, usually comes down to motivation.
I suppose when you're working and it's all for your family, isn't it? Really, like give your kids the best life they can possibly have. You want to be able to take them out and do things and go on really nice holidays and make sure that you've got a nice life ahead in the future. A little bit of pain now for a bit of gain later is kind of what I sort of, not what I live by, but just sort of, yeah, it's sort of, I think Yeah, I think the main why is just your family, just making sure that they can live the best life that they can.
Marsken reflects on the best advice he's received in his lifetime.
The best advice, probably not really in property, but when I was a kid, I don't know if I read it somewhere or heard it. I was just like, I was very, very sporty. I wanted to do it all, and it was kind of, I read somewhere, it was like a bit of a saying or a quote, like, you know, how do you expect to be better than someone that's training 40 hours a week when you're not? Like, as in, you know, if they're a professional, they're training 40 hours a week, how can you be better than them if you're only training 5 hours a week or 10 hours a week? So that's how you got to, and I kind of live by that a little bit as well. If you're doing something as a professional all the time, you're going to be better at it than everybody else. So that's probably one little one there.
Let's take a step back. If you say you met yourself, say, 10 years ago, what do you think you would have said to him?
I know everyone says, oh, I would have bought more property and whatever. And I think I would have started my business a bit sooner. I think I was lacking a bit of confidence in doing what I was doing. I kind of wasn't sure. I think I would have started my business a bit sooner, as in MPI Group. But in terms of what I've done in the last 10, I don't know. I think everything just happens for a reason. And when you're 10 years ago, I was 25 and just got home from overseas and was like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. You know what I mean? So, I know everyone says, oh, I would have bought, you know, 20 more properties and I'd be very rich right now. But yeah, I think, I probably would have, the only thing I would have done is probably started my business and have a bit more confidence in myself and what I was doing.
How much do you think out of your, I guess, the success that you've achieved at right now has been due to intelligence, hard work, and skill? And how much of it do you think has been due to luck?
I think a little bit of everything. Hard work's probably up there with probably the most, though. I remember, working all day and then going back to the houses and doing more work there for another 6-7 hours, just, painting or waterproofing or tiling or whatever, you know what I mean? Just to get the stuff done. And then you go back and work another day the next day. And, you can do that when you're younger and haven't got kids and it's fine. But now I don't think my wife would be too happy if I was doing that. So look, a lot of hard work. Intelligence, I don't think, I don't know. Maybe definitely not early on because I didn't buy the right properties early on, but intelligent enough to be able to keep them, like I said to you, and property can be very forgiving over time and the mistakes can get eroded pretty quickly. So intelligence to maybe hold them and then learn a bit more after it. But early on, I wasn't very intelligent with property. No, not at all. And a bit of luck as well. The market sort of moved nicely for me. But it's moved nicely everywhere in the last 12, 24 months. So we'll see what happens over the next 12, 24 months and we'll see where the luck rides there. But a little bit of everything. I think you need a little bit of everything, but you also get a bit of luck by throwing enough capital out there as well. You're not going to have any luck if the capital's sitting and doing nothing. That's the main thing. That's the main thing, I think. You got no chance of being part of the luck if you don't have a go at it,
Thank you to Paul Marsken, our guest on this episode of Property Investory.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.